history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women in your midst with incredible stories to tell. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we are educated every time. We're entertained and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you caught our last episode, you heard a little bit from 95-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley, how his mother left them when he was just one, how he was turned down by the Navy initially for being too short, but just had to get away from the stepmother he despised, and he chopped down trees in an upstate New York CCC camp until he was big enough for the Navy to take him. We even heard how decades after the war, he met Matsuo Fuchida, who had orchestrated and led the aerial attack on Pearl Harbor. And now we're going to hear from Stu what he experienced on December 7th, 1941.
I've heard many people say Pearl Harbor was a defeat. I don't agree with them. My opinion is it was an eye-opener because the minute Nimitz took command, he followed Admiral Yamamoto's procedure. He built the battle fleet around the aircraft carrier.
Big change in strategy.
Yes. And you see, the aircraft had come into its own. It was amazing because in talking to Fuchida, he clued me in that instead of using conventional bombs, which would never penetrate five steel decks to get to our handling rooms, he used armor-piercing shells and 15-inch armor-piercing shells. And in the torpedo deal, where we've got 35 and 40 feet of water in the harbor, he redesigned the torpedo by taking the elevator and the rudder off, which are steel, and put wooden ones on to give it buoyancy.
Yeah.
But then we've got a 16-inch armor belt from the after steering to the anchor windlass room. He's got to get through that. So he put a double warhead on the torpedo. In doing that, it stretched the torpedo out, so when they dropped them from the air, instead of going down 50 feet under the water, they went about 20, 25 feet underwater. When they were coming at us, we could see them coming through the water. My buddy, Johnny Anderson, he was in a motor launch coming alongside the gangway. When he saw one of those torpedoes, he pulled his boat up alongside the armor belt, jumped up on it, stuck his head and shoulders through a porthole. When that torpedo hit the side of our ship, the force of the water drove him right on through. He got up, ran topside, jumped over, and swam ashore. The Navy didn't know that. He was supposed to have been in turret 3 in the left gun, and if he had, he would have been burned beyond recognition, like 11 men were.
And I know you're going to tell us how close you came to being killed that day, but before we move away from Fuchida, I'm just wondering, since I've interviewed so many... vets, and I've heard the whole spectrum of feelings for the enemy then and now, you met the man who was responsible for the deaths of more than 2,000 Americans and almost claimed your life, too. So what was that like for you?
You're going to be astounded. I never had a hatred, any animosity toward the Japanese. And I'll tell you why. I lived for a whole year out in Kamiki, and we had a Japanese maid, a Japanese gardener, husband and wife, and a darling little boy. And I loved them. I looked at it this way when I was manning my battle station. You know, they're doing what they're told to do, just as I'm told. Because when I went to get my hat put on my head, I thought it was going to be with a fire and fighting away fire and rescue party. And when I reached for my hat, I got kicked right in the seat of the pants by a first-class bosun mate, Hicks. Get to your battle station on the double. This is the real thing. I grabbed my hat, I ran on top sight. Planes are diving from every direction. And similar to this, a gun sets up off the deck, and it's all open underneath. I saw this pilot, Lieutenant White, shooting with his 45. Well, I dove under there with him. Now, I'm a seaman first class. He's a lieutenant commander, so I'm not going to question. But I'm thinking. And he says, son, where's your battle station? And I put it up to gun three. He says, get up there as fast as you can. As I was going up the ladder to get in the turret, here come a Japanese torpedo plane down the port side. I could see the pilot, the radioman, and the co-pilot laughing like everything. I got inside the turret, and Crosen was already in the trainer's seat. Nobody was up on the gun deck, no shellman or rammers or anybody. So I went down to my battle station. When I go out to the schools, I put on a little demonstration. I point out how the Lord protected me. When I was 9 years old, I used to like to sit in the chair and lean back on the back two legs. My dad only spoke twice. Third time he acted. And you, yes, sir, and no, sir, in our house. So I was in the kitchen, and I'm leaning back on the back two legs. My dad walked in. Stuart, they made four legs and a chair to sit on the floor. Yes, sir. But how quick a nine-year-old forgets. So next time I'm leaning back, my dad says, Stuart, I'll not tell you again. Yes, sir. In this ear and out that ear. So the next time I'm leaning back, my dad walked in the kitchen, kicked the bag leg out from underneath me. I cracked my head on the floor. I said, there's got to be a better way. Now you see my legs back up under. That's 9 years old, a habit that I learned. I'm now 20 years old, and I'm in my battle station. Normally, my feet would be on a platform. I would be bent over, cranking in the dials for the elevation that they want that gun raised.
And this is a big 16-inch gun.
16-inch cannon.
How big are the projectiles in that?
It stands 5'2". It's 16 inches in diameter. They weigh 2,700 pounds. I called it a Volkswagen going out the barrel. And it takes 5 100-pound bags of black powder to hurl that shell from San Diego to Oceanside. That is, if I've got that gun elevated to maximum height, that shell will fly 30 miles.
I just wanted people to have a sense of this isn't a little anti-aircraft gun. This is the biggest you got.
So now I'm in my battle position, but we're not going to fire these 16-inch guns in Pearl. We'll blow Pearl Harbor off the map.
Yeah.
And so consequently, my feet were back up underneath me. I'm on a high stool. No back. J.A. phones on. And we could hear the machine gun bullets hitting the turret. We felt the thud of a torpedo. And Krause says, Stu, let's see what's going on. We took the sight cap off our periscope and bam, there went the Arizona. And I estimated there were about 32 bodies that flew through the atmosphere.
So I want people to understand what you're saying here, because very few people actually saw the Arizona
explode.
They saw the aftermath. They saw the smoke, or they heard it and they turned.
We saw it.
When you you looked into this viewfinder right before the bomb hit.
And see, I immediately thought that a bomb went down this stack because it looked like the ship broke in half. When I met this fellow here, I found out the truth. Jack McCarran was one that was blown off the ship into the burning oil. But he later informed me that he had been informed that an armor-piercing shell went through the starboard side of the forecastle right into number one handling room. There's 1,000 bags of black powder in each one of the handling rooms. That exploded. That set off turret two. That's what broke the ship in half.
But you're a 20-year-old kid.
I'm a 20-year-old brat growing up overnight.
And you're looking at a ship just like yours, another battleship.
Yep.
Blowing up and bodies flying through the air.
Yep.
How do you react to that?
Startled, surprised, but waiting for the next scenario.
Sure.
Because the next scenario was an armor-piercing shell dropped from a high-level bomber came through our turret. And what he'd done, he took 15-inch armor-piercing shells. Mm-hmm. They welded fins on them so that they would spiral. Well, over top of our left gun is a catapult, and I called it a slingshot. And we had two airplanes on that catapult that morning. One was a scout observation plane, an SOU-2, and the other was the Kingfish, the Admiral's plane. Well, the scout observation is a biplane.
Yeah.
The top wing is the gas tank. The Admiral's plane is a single wing. And when that shell hit, it hit the top wing of the scout plane. The gasoline exploded, burnt the plane to a crisp, split that catapult in half, and came down through 5 inches of steel right into the left gun. And the reason I'm here today is because that shell did not explode. And here's a picture of it taken on December the 9th. That's the inside of the turret.
And I'll put this picture up at hometownheroesradio.com. And I think some people who've been paying close attention are doing the math or following your drift on this. But go ahead and connect the dots for me from don't sit on two legs of a chair to the reason you're still here.
When the Arizona blew up, we didn't know it at the time. 1,177 men died instantly aboard that ship. You ever been out to Pearl?
Sure.
You've been aboard the memorial?
Yes.
You've seen the onyx wall, the plaque, with 1,177 names. But since then, there's been about, I would say, pretty close to 50 to 100 bodies put inside the ship.
Right.
So right after that explosion, I had my feet back up under. Right by my feet is a hatch, just big enough for a person to crawl through from one side to the other. It's locked down with four steel dogs. It blew that hatch right off those four steel dogs, that explosion. My footrest was just torn right off. If my feet had been out where they would be, I would have no legs, and I probably wouldn't be alive.
You wouldn't have made it off the ship.
No. Nobody would have known we were there because there was only the two of us in that right gun. And went right past my legs, underneath the elevating screw, past Crozen's legs, and landed against the barbette, picking both of us up simultaneously and throwing us 8 feet back into the elevating screw. Now, I had the JA phones on, and when I picked myself up off the deck, Crozen says, "Stu, let's get out of here." So I said, "A good idea," only he didn't say it quite that nice. And in order to get out, you got to go up a ladder to the primer deck. And when I got to the primer deck, I'd reached the end of the cord, and I grabbed a hold of the belt, snapped it in half, and threw the whole thing down in the pit. I spent 20 years trying to stretch one of those belts. Couldn't do it. And it wasn't until after I retired that I understood how it was possible. And I show the kids the Inquirer magazine that I had. And it says a mother lifted a one-ton car up off her son. And I said, that's an impossibility. But I read the article, then I understood. The adrenaline flows right through your body when you're in a state of excitement. So anyhow, we got on a topside. Our ship was on about a 15-degree list. Mm-hmm. And you can see the Tennessee is on one inboard of us. Now, a shell that hit the number two turret on the Tennessee killed my captain. Captain Bennion came out of his battle station, walked around the flying bridge over to the starboard side when a shell hit the edge of number two turret, and a piece of that shrapnel flew up and went through the lookout tower and tore my vice president's leg wide open. He got the Purple Heart. I never earned a Purple Heart for the whole war and the Korean War. And I told Crozen when we got out of topside, I says, if I don't get killed today, I'll live to see the end of this war. How can you say that, Stu? I said, if you've got the faith to believe it, you can do it. He says, I don't have that kind of faith. June 12th, 1942, he was on board the Honolulu. They took a torpedo through the bow of the ship. He was asleep in his bunk, and the steel crushed him to death. Hmm.
And we're still in the early stages of this attack on the morning of Sunday, December 7th, 1941. You're up topside, but the reason you're saying if I survive today is that's not a certainty. There's still a lot going on. What happened next?
Well, while Crozon and I were watching the Oklahoma capsize, 12 minutes, Ensign Sears, a junior officer of our division, was screaming for us to get over on the Tennessee. And what he wanted us to do was to straddle the line and jimmy across. Well, while we were watching the Oklahoma go over, a plane zoomed in between the two ships and machine gunned all five of our buddies, and they just toppled in between the ship.
So they're on the line between the two ships.
Yeah.
And they get picked off like sitting ducks by these Japanese machine gun bullets.
Yep.
And I could see, as you described that, that the emotions are still stirred when you recall that.
Oh, yes. And I told Crozon, we're not going over any lines. How are we going to get over, Stu? I says, I don't know yet, but we'll find a way.
And wait till you hear what that way was. Time for our first break, but we'll journey back again to December 7th, 1941 with Stu Headley in a moment. Find photos of Stu then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.